Good afternoon. This is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair for our weekly visit. It is one bell of the afternoon watch by Shipboard Time. And the greetings that I send out today in particular are to those people who make sure that they are huddled around their crystal receiver every Tuesday afternoon at 12:30 Pacific time, so as not to miss one of the golden words coming from the captain's chair, not to miss any of my pontifications. And I'm particularly grateful for those loyal listeners because they also are the ones who help to support the Voice of Vashon, 101.9 on the FM band and streaming live all over the world on voiceofvashon.org. I always like to think that at 12:29, all of my loyal listeners are sure to be someplace where they can gather around a crystal set or a receiver with vacuum tubes or transistors or however it is that they listen, and probably most of them listen by streaming on the World Wide Web. However you do it, and whatever you actually and really do and are doing while you listen to me, I am enormously grateful for your loyalty, for your love, and for your friendship. The binnacle list today, I am taking myself off of the binnacle list. I can't say that I have had a miraculous recovery similar to those that happen in Lourdes in France, but I am able to carry out all of my duties and all of the functions. I'm going to talk briefly about one of those duties that we are picking up for this year after the virus. And I am doing much better in all respects. My friend and colleague and teacher and student, Captain O'Brien, is not doing as well. And there are a number of other people who are close to me, close to your captain, who also are being moved up a level on the binnacle list. So it is there's not much that can be done for this particular virus. And in my case, I had some serious eye involvement, and there's no magic elixir that can fix that. You just put compresses, and then every morning when you wake up, your eyelids are frozen together, and you use a flat blade, not a Phillips, but a flat blade screwdriver to pry your eyelids open. It is my wish and my hope and my command that everybody get good rest, because that's just about the only thing that kicks this thing. And for those of you who are in much more serious situations, know that you are all in the palm of my hand. I am now at the point in my broadcast today where it is time to confess error. You all know that I do not do this well. I try to do it reasonably gracefully. And what happened, and I'm being guided by a sign at the Vashon Presbyterian Church, which is right across the street from the Gene Voss studio. And last week, the sign proclaimed that we should do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. Well, my first confession of error is that I have never walked humbly. And so it is difficult for me to accept and acknowledge that I make more mistakes than just the one that I allow myself each quarter. One of my regular and loyal listeners, one of those who huddles around his crystal set in North Carolina, who is also a shipmate, is reminding me that last week I spoke with some scorn about Navy ships, gray Navy ships, with running rust all over them. And I implied, if I did not come right out and say it, that that never happened in any cutters in the Coast Guard fleet, whether they be Whitehalls, which we've had, by the way, since the Great White Fleet at the turn of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century. And the red hulls, the black hulls, and the white hulls. And I must have implied that not a single streak of rust ever touched the sides of any of those ships. And certainly not any of those under the command of Captain Joe. It must be honestly reported, however, that at one place, I did indeed make some pejorative remarks about a couple of Coast Guard cutters that were not up to my standards in terms of the way that their crew and their captain and crew were taking care of them. And furthermore, and my shipmate in North Carolina did not remind me of this, but I am going to add it to my confessions of guilt. Furthermore, when I was in Hawaii in January with some close friends, and I took them onto the Coast Guard base at Sand Island, which is across from Aloha Tower in Honolulu Harbor. And a Coast Guard cutter had returned from a long and arduous patrol. And I know that it was a long patrol, and I know that it was arduous because I read the cruise report, and so I know what she accomplished. However, it was in the evening, and the side cleaners were not over the side. And in fact, it seemed to me that in-port routine had taken hold and that there was some work to be done to bring this particular ship up to the standards that we are entitled, all of you who are part owners of each one of these ships, are entitled to expect. So I did indeed, I have in the past, noted and remarked upon, and in the case of my own ships, when I spied rust beginning to develop, it was immediately brought to the attention of XO and to the first lieutenant. The first lieutenant is the officer who is in charge of the topside decks and the hull. So that's my confession of wrong for the for this week. And now I'm moving on to things where I still can do something about them. I had a wonderful telephone call yesterday from a lady of some senior years. And she said, "Captain Joe, I have the uniform of my father-in-law who served during World War II, and he served as part of one of the horse patrols. Happily and fortunately, the Coast Guard no longer has any horses, at least none of which I'm aware, because horses and I conceive an immediate and intense dislike for each other." So, but during World War II, we had beach patrols on horseback. And this Coast Guardsman was part of that. And she said, "I have his uniform. And I have his discharge papers. And I have a number of wonderful photographs. Would you be interested in having them?" And I said, "I would be delighted to have them." And in fact, inside the lighthouse right now, I have a mannequin. And this mannequin right now is dressed in a replica uniform of the lighthouse service 100 years ago. And it's time for him to doff that uniform and to put on a more modern Coast Guard uniform. And so when the parcel arrives from Colorado, I am going to put the uniform on the Coast Guardsman. He will now be a Coast Guardsman, not somebody from the Lighthouse Service. And I'm going to take the narrative that this lovely lady is sending me, and I'm going to construct a little display which will show what some of the things that not many people know about, but that we did during World War II. incredibly important work, if not in combat, where so many Coast Guardsmen served. So I was just delighted to be able to describe to her, as we talked on the telephone, the way that I was going to suit up our mannequin with the uniform that she's going to send me from that her father-in-law wore during World War II. I hope that it comes with the ribbons that he will have earned, and I know that it's going to come with some descriptions of his service and some stories. And so we're going to have a we're going to make a wonderful display. And although technically it may not be connected to Point Robinson, it is connected to part of our story, a story that I am so pleased and proud to be able to display on behalf of this particular Coast Guardsman, now long gone and over his own bar. The Coast Guard in Hawaii right now is tracking a Russian intelligence collection ship. She's off the coast of Hawaii. She's in international waters. She has every right to be there. I'm reminded of the Pueblo story. I've talked about Pueblo on this broadcast before, and I have very sad feelings about that whole story. It is my hope and wish that should any of the White Fleet or any of the Gray Fleet again find themselves in the same situation, that they would fight the ship. Those things have to be done. We cannot allow ourselves to be moved around at will by other nations. In any case, the intelligence collection, I've seen a photograph of her. She is in waters where she has every right to be. She is could well be, among other things, counting aircraft flights in and out of Hickam Air Force Base, which is right next door to HNL, Honolulu International Airport. You fly right over Hickam if you're on final going into HNL. Whatever she is collecting, she is where she has every right to be, and we have every right to hang around her and not to violate the rules of the road, but just to make sure that the Russians know that we are paying attention to whatever it is that they have going on. Another Coast Guard story came to me this morning, and I find this one to be particularly distressing, not because of the Coast Guard, but because of the story itself. The Coast Guard has made a declaration that illegal fishing all over the world surpasses piracy as a maritime threat. We've not talked too much about piracy, particularly in around Africa, off Somalia and places like that. We've not talked too much about that because... But if you will recall the story of Captain Phillips and the and his ship being captured by Somalian pirates, and that was both made into a film and also a book by Captain Phillips himself. I believe he's the one that wrote it, or he co-authored it. So this whole business of illegal fishing, at one time, and that time was not so very long ago, it was believed that fishing stocks would tolerate any amount of fishing, including overfishing. And now we've learned, of course, that that's not true. We almost fished out the Atlantic cod. And the story of the tuna fisheries in the Pacific is one of particular interest and concern. It's a particular interest to me because I was very much involved with that. My first command was as the captain of a patrol cutter out of San Diego, which is the home of the California tuna fisheries, tuna clippers, Tuna clippers, 250 feet, very large vessels, larger than I was. I think I've towed just about every one of them at one time or another. And so when I assumed command of that cutter, we were right at the turn of the end of long line fishing for tuna, where a single line would be thrown over the side with a big heavy gang hook. And once it hit the tuna, which had been chummed to the surface, the tuna would hit anything. They didn't have to put any bait on the hook. The tuna would hit the hook. And the person who was handling the pole would bring the pole back and bring the tuna up, and one of the youngsters would be behind his dad or his uncle and take the tuna off of the long line. And there might be 10, 15 of these lines lined up along the side of the vessel. But then what happened was the invention of the power block, a great big electric motor up at the top of a long boom, and the invention of the synthetic monofilament line nets made into a purse seine. And the purse seine would be put into the water, and a small boat would pull the end of it around the school of tuna. And then the power block would pick up the net, would close the purse, and pick up hundreds of tuna all in one catch. So we went from getting at each haulback with the long line tuna fishery, 8 or 9 at a time, we were picking up 100, 150. As a parenthetical insertion, one of the things that happened was that tuna would school along with dolphin, and dolphin would get also caught in the nets. The catching of dolphin under the terms of the Marine Mammals Act was forbidden, and so a way had to be found to get the dolphin out of the net before the haulback. That's another story for another time. So I was involved in that fishery right when they were transitioning from the family-owned boats with the long lines to the power block, picking up these purse seines, and picking up 100 or 120 tuna at a time. The fishery at that time was so extensive that there was not any danger of overfishing, but of course that carried on and carried on and carried on, and there became less and less tuna. Another interesting aspect of the tuna fishery was the yellowfin tuna, which was fished all over the Pacific, and how we figured out where those vessels were, and sometimes they would overfish because there were restrictions on the amount of yellowfin tuna. All of these specific examples are to tell you that the fisheries, which so much of the world depends on for its food supply, for its protein supply, is in fact not infinite. And right now it is the Chinese with huge fleets, and huge fleets working all over the Pacific. And many of those are taking more of the catch than that to which they are entitled. I'm going to be following this story because I am particularly interested in the fisheries. I've worked in fisheries enforcement off and on for a good part of my career. And in fact, not only was I a captain of that cutter, but a number of years later, I became captain of another one of our cutters that patrolled the Grand Banks, Cape Sable, and in particular, patrolling with the Russians. The Russians and the Poles, Hungarians, just about all of the Middle European countries were fishing up off of the Grand Banks with not only catcher boats, but also with factory ships. And so so I've always been interested in this particular subject. It's one of the things that I talk over with my friend Bill West when I have him on. And I'm going to keep on top of this particular story because it is both an important one from a geopolitical point of view, but it's also an important one from the point of view of the world's food supply. All of us are recruiters or should be recruiters for our military. I am aware that all of the military services are having difficulties recruiting young people, young men and women. One of the reasons for this is that many of them don't want to subject themselves to military discipline. And many of them are not eligible to join because of physical deficiencies. We have a generation of young people, many of whom cannot physically qualify to join any one of the military services. In my own service, the Coast Guard, the commandant has proclaimed that recruitment is very difficult and all of us are recruiters. I could not agree with that more. And I am aware of several young people that have been sent to me for some talk about what they're going to do with their lives. And two of them are in the Coast Guard. One of them is a rescue swimmer, one of the most highly trained and skillful of our enlisted ratings, also one of the most dangerous. And so I, whenever I talk to young people about where they're headed in their lives, I tell some stories about my own life. When I was 17, of course, I went to the academy for the first time, and I knew that I was in the right place, and I've had a love affair with the service ever since. Every day was a day where I was ready to semper paratus, ready to be a part of whatever the day would bring. It has got to be absolutely awful. And I have a couple of people in my immediate family who are in work situations that are unhappy. It's got to be terrible to wake up and know that you have to go and slog and push in a working environment that you neither respect nor enjoy. I've never had that happen to me. And for that, among many, many, many other things, I am the most fortunate of men. So the commandant is, she persists, however, in using a term that if I were going to be her advisor on how to recruit, she uses a term called workforce. I am not part of a Coast Guard workforce. I command a Coast Guard cutter that is made up of shipmates. These are people for whom I am completely and totally responsible for their training, for their health, for their safety, for their safe return at the end of every mission. And in return for that, they are responsible to me for obedience and for being a shipmate. A shipmate is he or she who puts mates and ship before themselves. The word shipmate seems to be missing somewhere in the lexicon of my service these days. So, Admiral, if you want me to be an advisor to you on how to oversubscribe your recruitment quotas, I will be happy to do that. And the first thing I will advise you to do is to deep six the word workforce and bring back to its pride of place the word shipmate. and that all of the training that starts at Cape May or starts at the academy or starts at the officer candidate school, all of that training is going to be pivoted around that magical word, shipmate. And the word workforce is never going to be heard or seen anywhere in the Coast Guard again. I can't do much with what Admiral Gilday, who is the Chief of Naval Operations, coming soon, one hopes, to the end of his term. But I can't do much with what the Commandant of the Marine Corps does if he insists on calling his infantrymen, and every Marine is trained as an infantryman, and I hope they still are. The Marines in my family were. And so if he insists on using the term workforce, that's up to him. And certainly the Air Force. I don't know much about the Space Force. I am one of those who felt that the Space Force should never have been created. And if it ends up being secured sometime within my lifetime, I will not be particularly sad, because the Air Force was doing a wonderful job with all of those things, and the Navy in particular. So that's what I have to say about all of that. Workforce gone, shipmate back, and all of our training hinges around teaching people to be shipmates, he or she who puts his mates and his ship, his command, before himself. Whenever I relieved a ship, or whenever I was relieved in due course of time, or when I relieved my shore command, my much-loved group command up in Sault Ste. Marie in Michigan, which is, by the way, I'm going to up there this summer. I'll be broadcasting from up there this summer. And whenever I would be either relieved or being relieved, I would talk about shipmates. And when I was being relieved, I always was able to say that just about everybody in that command had fulfilled my hopes and my thoughts about being a proper shipmate. I never heard the word workforce, and you will never hear me say it again on this broadcast. So we're all going to be recruiters. I'm going to continue talking to other people about coming into the U.S. military, not necessarily the Coast Guard. Each service offers its own particular advantages, its own particular challenges, and it can be a wonderful way of life. It can be a very dangerous way of life. There is no training that doesn't have some risks to it. There's 1,300 hours already, which is two bells of the forenoon watch, and it then becomes necessary for your Captain Joe's to say once again that we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And now that I am off of the binnacle list, even though my voice is not quite back up to my from the captain's chair level, know that I remain, as always, on station and watching properly. With much love and yet full pontification from the captain's chair, this is your Captain Joe.